night, the shadows against the dark, drifting in and out of consciousness. The shadows shifting as clouds passed in front of the moon, the dark shapes in my peripheral vision creeping like monsters. The cops hadn't found anything yet. No hard evidence. Or if they had, they weren't talking. And that didn't sound like them. Not the ones I knew. Officer Fraze had been a cop 10 years ago when Corinne disappeared. He'd told his wife about Jackson and Bailey and Tyler and me. His wife was the school secretary. Maybe he thought she'd know something that would help with the case. Maybe he was looking for information. But he was really giving it away. Bailey and Jackson? Corinne and Tyler? Do you remember Daniel Farrell? Tell me about them. Tell me everything. Jimmy Bricks had been a senior when Daniel was a freshman. In addition to being the first Bricks to attend college, he held the school record for the most beers funneled at a time. The record remained unbroken by the time I graduated. We were too close in age. Our circles overlapped. We'd see him at parties when he was home from college. He told rumors about Corinne as if they were facts from a police investigation and not the other way around. It wasn't until they brought in Hannah Pardoe from the State Bureau of Investigation that the case gained traction. Detective Hannah Pardoe, who never smiled, not even when she was trying to play nice, with her piercing eyes and the blood-red lipstick that sometimes stained her teeth. She made me the most nervous, mostly because she was once an 18-year-old girl. She seemed to know there was more to Corinne than anyone could say. She was in her 30s back then, with curly auburn hair and gray eyes that revealed nothing. Maybe she'd had kids and settled down by now. Maybe she took an early retirement. Or maybe the cases shuffled in and out and we didn't last with her. Not like she'd lasted with us. Hannah was thorough and tight-lipped, concentrating on the cold, hard facts. If she'd been here from the beginning, maybe she would have discovered what had happened to Corinne. Maybe if she were here now, they'd find out what happened to Annalise. The facts. The facts were difficult to see clearly. The facts were like the view from our porch. Shadows in darkness and shapes you could conjure up from fear itself. There was something out there. Feet crunching leaves. Getting louder. Moving closer. Someone running. Adrenaline propelled me to my feet as the blood rushed to my head. The footsteps were moving faster, approaching from my left. I held my breath, strained to see, but whoever it was remained hidden inside the tree line. He continued past my house, the leaves crunching under his steps at a steady pace before an extended pause as he leaped across the creek that had long ago dried up, onto Carterland. I looked for my phone, inside, and thought of the time it would take for someone else to get here, the footsteps fading as I debated what to do. Go. I was quick through the grass, but my bare feet recoiled as I entered the woods, turning my steps tentative. I bit back a yelp as a sharp twig caught my ankle, and I held on to a tree, listening for the sound of footsteps. Nothing but silence now. Had he heard me? Was he gone? I held my breath, gripping the tree, and counted to 20. Still no sound. I stepped carefully, pausing every few seconds to listen until I reached the hill between our property and the Carters. I crouched low, climbing the hill on my hands and knees, trying to get a better view of the place through the trees. There. A light. A shadow moving in front of the gap between the shades from inside the converted studio. I moved closer, sidestepping down the hill. The light was dim, not strong enough to be coming from a lamp, just a flicker through the shades. A flashlight? A television screen? A computer, maybe? I sneaked closer, but the shades moved aside and the shadow peered out. The way the moonlight angled into the window caught the eyes, set off a glow, and I closed my own eyes in case they were doing the same. I slid behind the nearest tree, kept my back pressed against the trunk, and tried to slow my breathing. A door latched. A lock turned. The other person was outside now. I heard movement in the leaves, circling around. slowly at first, coming closer, and then faster, moving away into the distance. I waited for minutes, maybe longer, before heading back to my house, my legs shaking, my feet numb to the trail. Someone had been inside Annalisa's place in the middle of the night. Someone who knew the woods well. Someone who had a key. Someone who could run in the dark by heart. The shower ran cold, and I wasn't sure whether I was shaking from the temperature or the leftover adrenaline, but the water felt good. The heat of the day had already begun, and I hadn't even started looking for someone to fix the air conditioning. Tyler had said it was probably the condenser fan, but Daniel wanted a second opinion. A real opinion was what he actually said. I got dressed, started a pot of coffee, sank into a kitchen chair, and rested my head on my arms while it brewed. I tried to lull my mind, empty it, drift off into a worry-free oblivion. But I had to try to catch Tyler before he left. I had to look into his eyes when I asked. I had to know. Just one more minute. Just a moment, and then I'd go. The coffee was lukewarm by the time I pulled myself from the table. Shit. I downed a quick cup instead of breakfast and hopped in the car, driving straight to Kelly's pub. Tyler's truck was already gone, but I could see the dim lights from the pub through the dirty window. Jackson's bike was in the back lot like always. Though it was a Wednesday morning, there were a few men at the bar already. Whiskey in a glass, beer in a bottle, and a bowl of mixed nuts on the counter between them. The bell rang as I pushed through the front door. Jackson locked eyes with me from behind the bar.
"Can I help you with something?"
When I got closer, I could see he was biting back a smirk. "God, do you work here all the time?" I asked.
"It's my job,"
he said, rough hands pressed flat against the counter, leaning so his muscles strained against his T-shirt, the tattoos on his forearms rippling with life. His nails were bitten down to the quick, and I couldn't tell whether his fingertips were stained with liquor or nicotine.
"By the way, you missed him by a few hours."
He said this without looking me in the eye. Jackson and I were always cautious with each other. Even when his words carried the weight of a threat, they were buried under something else. I knew too much of him, and he of me. Too much we learned about each other and Corinne during the investigation. It was only after she disappeared that I realized how little my best friend had shared with me. When I couldn't find the answers to the exacting questions from Hannah Pardoe. What did she think of her parents? What did she say about Jackson? Did you know she had plans to meet him? What was she asking him about in his message? I could only answer the hypotheticals, those I knew. Would she have gone off with someone she just met? Would she run away? Would she take your boyfriend and pretend it was for your own good? But what was her state of mind? The things with substance, the tangible, real answers? Those were elusive. I knew only the Corinne who existed in the hypotheticals, the theoretical possibilities. Would she, could she, might she? It wasn't until Hannah Pardoe broke her open that I knew all of her. Corinne Prescott, more real, presumed dead than alive. Jackson got away with the things he kept hidden. I didn't see her. She never found me. I don't know what the message was about. But only because I never called him on it. Back then, people wanted to believe him. Jackson Porter. He loved Corinne. He would never. There was something about him when we were teenagers. Something about his appearance that made people want to believe him. He didn't look honest, exactly, but his features made him seem trustworthy. People saw his brown eyes, which were large and framed by eyelashes too long for a guy, and made him seem like he was always listening even when he wasn't. And his hair, which was exactly the same color as his eyes, something that seemed perfectly logical, that made you want to trust him. But it was more than that. It was the symmetry of him, made him seem incapable of deceit. When Corinne disappeared and the questions began, I was seized by the sudden thought that Jackson could, and always had been able to, get away with anything. And I knew he was lying. I didn't want to be in a room with him or talk about him. And it was this that Hannah Pardoe seized on. Not my words, but the distance I tried to put between myself and Jackson. This unwillingness to comment on anything Jackson said, to neither confirm nor deny. I switched to I don't know, which was all Corinne had left me with anyway. It didn't matter in the end. Bailey cracked at the first tap, after hearing about the pregnancy test in Corinne's bathroom. Filled that box with each of our betrayals and all of her fears. Told Hannah Pardoe what she wanted to hear. Nick, she thinks she's too good for this place, but she's nothing without us. Nothing. And, no, we didn't know Corinne was pregnant, but it must have been Jackson's, and that must have been what her voicemail was about, and Jackson didn't want it, obviously. Bailey followed the pieces Hannah laid out for her, feeding her back the story she demanded, that Corinne was impulsive and reckless. She'd burned down the Randall barn, even. And I was still pissed about her hitting on Tyler at the party. And Daniel was always too harsh on me. Emphasis on harsh. Jackson wasn't going to forgive her this time, Bailey said. He told me so. It was him. It had to be him. He didn't want her or the baby. Bailey made it a story, and since she was one of Corinne's best friends, that made it real. Everyone else adding layers over the top. I heard her throwing up in the bathroom. She didn't wear those cropped shirts anymore because obviously she was hiding it. She was ashamed. Jackson dumped her, the poor girl. That poor, poor girl. Brought it on herself, though, you know. I don't know what came over me when I found out. Why I pushed Bailey. Why I yelled. Why I accused her of ruining Jackson. Why I cared. Because she did ruin him. That was the story people ultimately believed, even if no one could ever prove it. And that was why he was working at this bar, all alone. And why he never had a girl who stuck around. Now those same eyes, with the impossibly long lashes, made him seem like he was listening too much. Eavesdropping. Plotting. His appearance was too coincidental. The symmetry of him was the mask. And he, the monster behind it. This bar was the safest place to put him. Why don't you leave, Jackson? He didn't answer. His tattoos rippled as he wiped down the bar between us. But I thought I knew. You wait for people here. For people to come back. For things to make sense.
Why do you keep coming back?
He asked. I'm helping out with my dad.
So you're only coming back for him?
He smirked again, avoiding my gaze. I dropped onto a bar stool. Since when did it become socially acceptable to drink at breakfast? I asked. Jackson pressed his lips together, looking at me for a beat too long.
It's after lunch.
I checked the clock behind the bar, staring at the second hand, jerking to a stop with each movement. I must have been out for an hour or two at the kitchen table, trading time in the day for the sleep I wasn't getting at night.
What do you want, Nick?
I drummed my fingers on the counter like my dad might do, then stopped myself, held them flat, willed them not to shake from the caffeine. Do you know where Tyler works?
Same place he's always worked.
You know what I mean. Tyler didn't have an office. He and his dad used to work out of their home where Tyler was happy to live until what I considered way past an acceptable age. He said he'd rather save the money. But then you'd have to spend it on a motel whenever you want to take a girl back to your place, I'd teased him, standing too close. He'd grinned and said,
I just take them to theirs.
And he'd taken me back to my place to prove his point. But now he lived here, in an apartment above a bar, and I wasn't sure if he still worked out of his parents' house or was on site today. Jackson threw the rag on the counter and motioned for me to follow him out of the bar, out of earshot. We stood in the vestibule between the front door and the staircase, and he leaned in close.
Stay away from him right now. Trust me.
What are you talking about? I felt the men in the bar leaning closer, trying to hear. Felt all the rumors that could come from this moment. Jackson and Nick whispering about the case. Jackson and Nick standing too close.
Annalise Carter,
he said.
They're pushing Tyler hard on it. and you being here doesn't look good for him.
How do you know this?
It doesn't matter. Just don't add more fuel to the rumors, Nick.
What rumors? He cut me off with a look, and I brushed the comment aside. I'm engaged. I just need to talk to him.
You need to stay away from him. Annalise was...
He trailed off, thinking. Annalise was still a 13-year-old girl to me. I'd left and missed what she had become. Annalise was what?
She was obsessed.
He cleared his throat.
With Corinne. She'd been hanging out here a lot, being way too friendly, asking questions.
About what happened?
Not really. It's not like she was obsessed with what happened exactly, just... her.
Jackson looked over my shoulder into the bar, his mouth close to my ear.
She'd say things I swear Corinne used to say to me in the same tone of voice. It was creepy, Nick. Seriously fucking creepy. She could do a pretty sick impression of her.
His jaw tensed. Every muscle in his body tensed.
I never... She creeped me out more than anything, but the cops still talked to me. They were here just this morning. I bet they're with Tyler now, since they also wanted to know where he worked. Bet they'll talk to your brother soon enough.
Daniel? Why the hell would they talk to him? Jackson's lips pressed together, and he stared back, unwavering. You're not serious, I said. Daniel wouldn't. He shrugged.
I hear she called him a lot. She'd come in here looking for him, just like you're looking for Tyler right now. Hear his wife spent a few days at her sister's place a few months back. Don't know if it was related. Rumors. You know how it goes.
Rumors. They always start from something. Daniel hadn't told me Laura had left, but then again, would he? Just tell me where he works, Jackson.
I really don't know,
he said, his eyes sliding away from me. Lie. Again. He left me standing in the entrance to the bar, and somewhere along the way I felt myself losing a grip on everything I'd fought to hold together, my family, and as the panic surged up and over, I lost all semblance of pride. I followed him in, raised my voice in the dim quiet. Does anyone know where I can find Tyler Ellison? The man with the whiskey coughed into his fist. I walked over to him, stood too close. Do you know? I asked, leaning so close that the liquor on his breath stung my eyes. He held the glass between us like a shield, smiled as he raised it to his lips.
Nah, I'm just curious what he did to make a girl barge into a bar looking for him.
He laughed to himself. The man with the beer ignored him. He frowned and tipped his glass toward me.
Patrick Farrell's daughter, right?
The other man went silent. I nodded.
Ellison Construction's got a project going on at the railway. New station. Funded by the goddamn township.
He took a gulp of his beer, dropped it to the counter.
For the goddamn tourists.
The other man mumbled something about money and funding and streets and the schools.
My guess, you'll find him there. How's your dad?
Not good, I said. Worse. He's getting worse.
You selling the house? That what I hear?
I don't know, I said. Everything was fluid again. Dad hadn't signed the papers, but the house was just the tip of the thing now. I turned to leave, and Jackson grabbed my arm.
Be smart,
he said. And like an echo, I heard Tyler whispering to Jackson down by the river. Be smart, he said. And then I stepped on a twig and they both turned around, pretended they were talking about something else. Jackson told the police he didn't see her after the fair, Nick, Tyler told me later. He claims he never saw her at all that night. But that was a lie. I saw Jackson and Corinne after the fair. But if I said that... You had to understand the way things were, the stories people could weave from the few facts they had, the truths they pulled together from that box. They needed someone to blame, someone to vilify and put in a cell so they could feel safe again, someone to play the part, be the monster. I couldn't tell them that. It would be enough to close the box forever. I'd be sentencing him. Jackson wasn't some pushover who let Corinne wrong him time and time again. He wasn't some angry kid who felt betrayed, like the investigation would have you believe. It had nothing to do with any baby, any fight. When Corinne turned on him, cut him down and made him push back enough to push her away, he liked it. I know this because we all did. He liked it because of what came next, the phone call begging him to return. That phone message they played for all of us. Please, please come back. The way she'd love him, surely, when he did. Nobody would ever love you so fiercely, so meanly, so thoroughly. And the parts of you that you wanted to keep hidden, she loved those most of all. Nick, she'd said when my mom died, pulling me to her chest, crying herself. I love you. I'd trade you one if I could. You know that, right? I clung to her, not speaking. Corinne would talk like that, like people were things to trade, pieces on a chessboard that we could move around, that we could control. Want to watch something burn? She'd asked. That night we went to the Randalls' abandoned barn. She had a red container of gasoline that she shook out, tracing the perimeter. She let me strike the match, and she held my hand as we watched it burn to the ground. We stood too close to it, so close we could feel each time a piece of wood caught, sparked, ignited. She called Tyler to come pick me up and told us to say we'd been together the whole night. Go, she'd said, right before she called 911. She took the fall for the barn all on her own. I told them I was practicing how to make a fire, like in the Girl Scouts, in case of emergency. It got out of hand. Her smile huge. The whole thing just a tiny favor. 6 months of community service and the wrath of her father, a small gift to help me through my mother's death. How could I not love Corinne Prescott back then? How could anyone not? I liked to believe it was for the things like this, and not because I was drawn to the mean in her, or how she could destroy things without flinching, a dying bird, an abandoned barn. I liked to believe she did these things because she loved me, too. I can see it all a little clearer now with the filter of time, how if you tilt the frame and change the perspective, maybe she wasn't taking the fall only for me. That maybe it was just one more link in a chain of IOUs, emotional blackmail that would one day be called up and cashed in. I think Corinne believed that life could break even somehow, that there was an underlying fairness to it all, that the years on Earth were all a game, a risk for a payoff, a test for an answer, a tally of allies and enemies, and a score at the end. I know now that everything we did or said, and everything we didn't, was kept in a ledger in her mind, and always in the back of ours, too. I called Daniel from the car on my way to find Tyler. He picked up on the first ring.
Hello?
He said, typing in the background. Tell me you were not messing around with Annalise Carter. The typing stopped.
Jesus Christ, Nick.
Damn it, Daniel. Are you kidding me? What the hell were you thinking? What the hell were you doing? And Laura?
I know you're not lecturing me on fidelity, Nick, but no,
he said.
No.
More emphatically. But I didn't believe him. This is what you say when you're being questioned. This is what you cling to against all else, against all evidence. This is what you say, and you pray that someone will back you up. I'd done it for him once before. 10 years earlier, I'd heard Hannah Pardoe asking my brother in the living room, were you and Corinne ever in any sort of relationship? I pressed my ear to the grate on the bathroom floor and heard him swear, never. Never. When my turn came around, I repeated his words. Never, I said. Never.
Nick, are you listening to me?
Daniel's voice tightened through the phone. Jackson said,
Jackson doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about. I've got a lot of work to catch up on, so do you need anything else, or were you just calling for the interrogation?
Okay, okay. I hung up, feeling sick to my stomach. Once again, I saw a missing girl in the center of a web, Jackson's words twisting into a warning. Annalise had been worming her way into the lives of anyone connected to Corinne Prescott, as if she'd been looking for something. A missing poster lingered in my peripheral vision at the stoplight, her eyes wide and searching. A shudder ran through me, the tremor in my hands coming back. I was looking for something, too. I wondered if maybe she'd found it. Tyler wasn't at the railway station. He was about 100 yards past it, where they were extending the track, a wide frame and cement base already in place. Across the street, even surrounded by men all dressed the same, worn jeans, tan work boots, and a T-shirt, the same uniform he'd adopted 11 years ago, I could pick him out right away. Whereas the rest of the crew had on yellow hard hats, he wore a black baseball cap with ECC in block letters across the front. A skinny man looked over Tyler's shoulder, gestured with his chin.
"I think you got some company."
Tyler turned in slow motion. His face remained passive as he took me in, which was the most un-Tyler-like thing of all. Normally, I'd show up and he'd turn and smile. "Hey, Nick," like I'd been gone only a day. Not 6 months, a year, more. But now his face didn't change.
"Hi,"
he said, the twitch of his thumb the only indication that I was anything other than a stranger. His eyes shifted quickly to the side, to where the skinny man was watching us.
"Can I help you with something?"
"I need to speak with you. It's urgent." I mentally berated myself. Urgent, like Everett would say in a business meeting.
"Sure."
He gestured to a small trailer, and I worried I'd have to talk in front of his father, but when I got inside, I realized the office was his. Single desk, his truck keys sprawled on top of some papers, a few straight-back chairs throughout, plans and permits tacked to the corkboard walls. When he'd worked for his dad during school, and then after, I'd always thought it was temporary. That he'd want something more, like I did. But he didn't go to college when he graduated, and I should have known it then. Not just assumed he was working for his dad because he was waiting for me. 10 years later, and he was running the company. 10 years later, 2 fewer degrees than I had, and he was twice as accomplished. He followed me in, closed the door, and leaned back against it.
"Sorry, I wasn't expecting you."
He glanced out the window.
"This really isn't the best time."
"I'm sorry, but something happened." I tried to get a good look at his face, but the brim of his hat was pulled down low and I couldn't see his eyes, just his mouth, a set line.
"What happened?"
he asked, his back still pressed up against the door. The distance between us felt tangible, forced and awkward. "Last night, after midnight, someone was in Annalisa's place." A muscle at the side of his jaw twitched. I wanted to rip the hat off his head. I needed to see his eyes.
"And you know this because?"
"Because I saw them."
"Nick, you've got to stay out of the fucking woods. You've got to let this go."
"Tyler."
"What?"
he asked. "I have to ask you." I paused, wishing he wouldn't make me. He readjusted the brim of his hat, turned to stare out the window.
"What exactly do you need to ask me?"
How many ways could I say it? I stepped closer, but his face remained in shadow. "Was it you?" He looked back to me like the whole conversation had caught him off guard.
"Was what me? What the hell are you talking about?"
I lowered my voice, even though we were alone. "Were you in her place last night? After midnight?" I asked. Tyler turned and fixed his eyes on mine. "What are you saying, Nick?" Until I had to look away. "Do you have a key?" I asked.
"Are you fucking kidding me right now?"
"You never told me," I said. "You never told me whether you were serious or just screwing her." He took his hat off, ran his hand through his hair, pulled it back down. He shifted his lower jaw around.
"Just screwing, Nick. Happy?"
"No, I'm not happy." My voice wavered, and I took a slow breath to steady myself. Someone was in there.
"Probably the police, since they were just here."
"Fuck. Fucking Jackson being fucking right. What did they want? What did you say?" He looked out the window again.
"They want to find Annalise, and they want to poke holes in my alibi. They want to catch me in a lie.
I paused, thinking. What is your alibi, Tyler? He grimaced.
That's the problem. I don't have a fucking alibi. My alibi is just that I wasn't there, except I obviously was a few hours earlier. So my alibi is that I wasn't there when she went missing, that we didn't have a fight that got out of hand.
That's what they think? He shrugged.
That's the story they seem to want. That I called her, we fought. For some reason they haven't quite worked out yet, we agreed to meet up in the woods. She accused me of being with you. I did something.
He reached out in front of him, fingers curling in as if closing around her slender neck. It's up to them to prove that, I said.
Is it? Is it really? If everyone already believes it, and then you show up at my work in the middle of the day?
Sorry, I whispered, heat rising to my face. I'm sorry I came. I just needed to know. He nodded.
No, I'm sorry. I'm pissed. I'm pissed at them, not at you. It was probably the police in her place, Nick.
No, not the police. There weren't any cars. Someone on foot. Someone who didn't want to be seen. Someone who had a key. Someone who knew the woods by heart.
Her family, then.
Through the woods, Tyler. Someone walked through the woods. Then he stared again, walked toward the door, readjusted the brim of his hat so it was perfectly centered, nodded once.
It wasn't me.
He looked me over once more.
Go home,
he said.
Get out of here before they come knocking on your door, too.
I followed him out the trailer door into the sunlight, the work site too bright, like an overexposed photo. Meals started blending together along with the hours, losing structure just as the days had been. Sleep was hard to come by, and I overcompensated with too much caffeine all day. It was after 9 p.m. by the time I remembered to eat. There were too many possibilities. All those names and events tied together in that hypothetical box, weaving around, untangling in my mind. And more. The stories that never made it inside the box. The things we never asked each other, slowly unraveling. To solve a mystery here, you can't come from the outside. There were people here who knew more than they said, who chose to keep it silent, like Jackson seeing Corinne, like me seeing them together. There must be more of us. I had to understand the silence. With Corinne comes Annalise. With Annalise comes Corinne. Apply one filter to the next. Watch it all slide into focus. There was a light outside the window in the woods. Someone near her place again. I didn't bother grabbing my phone. Just the flashlight that had been in the drawer beside the microwave as long as I could remember. I was losing them, and I couldn't. I had to know. The new cop from state, staying at the motel in town? Someone else? Annalise? Find them. Find answers. I sneaked through the yard like I used to when I was a kid, keeping silent into the shadows until I reached the tree line. I saw the flashlight bobbing periodically in the distance, and I sprinted toward it until I got too close. I kept my own light off. The moon was enough for my footing, or maybe that was my memory. But the light wasn't moving toward Annalise's place anymore, or my own. It was heading away, backtracking, moving sure-footedly and with purpose through the forest, toward a hiding spot maybe, or a car on the other end. We'd been moving for at least half an hour, and a sliver of panic had wedged itself inside my chest. I was at the disadvantage. I was alone. I was unarmed, unprotected, with no phone or map or GPS. My options were to keep following the flashlight or stop with no sense of where I was. And yet, I had the sense that I knew where we were heading. Not from the direction, but from the timing. I'd taken this trek before at night. But it wasn't until we reached the clearing that I was sure. Big open space set back from the road. Small narrow path, cordoned off, leading to the caverns. I stayed in the woods, watching the flashlight. Eventually, another light appeared on the path, and I willed it closer until it shone on the person I was following. For a moment, I think I expected to see skinny arms and blonde hair and huge eyes, pale skin and dirty clothes. Maybe it was nothing but hope, but there it was. I expected to see Annalise. But it was a boy, a teenager, her brother, and the person with him was a tall girl with dark hair, an arm held up to shield her eyes. God, you're blinding me, asshole.
Where's David?
Bringing the drinks. Carly's in the car. She doesn't like it out here when it's just us. Says it's not safe. The girl paused. Any word about your sister?
Nah,
he said, lowering the flashlight. I'm sorry, Bryce, she said. Bryce. Right. He didn't look particularly shaken up by the fact that his sister was missing. And they didn't look the same. Not like Daniel and I used to. Bryce was stocky, had inherited his father's square jaw and broad shoulders.
Could still turn up,
he said. 9 days, and that was all he could say. I'd find it suspicious if I didn't already know his type. Part of a generation of kids expecting everything handed to them. The missing people returned. The mystery solved for them. 10 years ago, we'd torn these woods to pieces. We'd followed the cops to the places they searched, and we'd searched the places they didn't. But not these kids. Apparently, they could just shrug it off, give their condolences, wait for the beer to arrive. Maybe it was that Annalise wasn't theirs. A little too old. She'd already left. Gone to college. Come back. She didn't belong to them or to us. Lost in the gap, with no one to seek her out. I heard an engine and shrank away from the flashlights and headlights. There he is, the girl said. Come on, the woods creep me out. My brother used to tell me there was a monster. Bryce nodded and followed her. If you let yourself get swept away in legend, let it become more than story, then it's not such a stretch to imagine Corinne disappearing without a trace. It happens all the time, all across the country, especially in the woods in the middle of the night. And if Corinne did, then so could Annalise. Wasn't a stretch to imagine a monster, even. Watching and waiting and making you do things. Breathing in the lick of smoke as the teenagers made a fire. Watching them fall all over each other in a heap of beautiful limbs. Feeling the cold dirt settle under its nails as it waited. Listening to the theories and the stories and the bullshit. Waiting until they fell asleep so it could creep back to the caverns and see what, if any, secrets they had to offer. It's not so hard. From where they were sitting, there was something doing the same, and they had no idea. Right then, I was the monster. The day before. Day 9. I had my back pressed against the bedroom wall, ear to the open window, like a kid eavesdropping on the conversation outside. Daniel trying to send the police away, to stop them from dragging us into yet another investigation. Stay out of it, he'd said to me, and he was right. I'd already given my statement to Officer Fraze, useless as it must have been. Did you see anything in the woods? Hear anything that night? Anything at all? No, sir, no, sir, no, sir. I had no relationship with Annalise. There was nothing on paper tying us to each other except in that hypothetical box in the police station from 10 years ago, and that was just a corroboration of alibi. And yet here was a new cop out front, asking to speak with me. His voice was gravelly but tentative. Careful.
If I could just ask her a few questions about her relationship with Tyler Ellison.
And there it was. Tyler. Tyler ties to me, and me to Daniel. Suddenly, the whole knotted mess of us is sucked down, prodded and pried until we reveal something unintentional. Something used to break apart the other. Hannah Pardoe was an expert at that. This guy? Not so much. He was tripping over Daniel, or Daniel was overpowering him. Either way, this cop wasn't getting in to see me.
I think she's sleeping, I heard Daniel say. Look, I'm on my way to work, so I can't stick around. Maybe try again this afternoon. It's important. A woman is missing, and every day she's not found, she's more at risk. It's our moral duty to track down every possible lead.
Like it had come straight from witness questioning 101. What was he, a month out of training? Moral duty. Hilarious. Like it was their moral duty to crack open every facet of anyone's life, anyone who came within 3 degrees of separation, to destroy the living to find the dead. It had been 8 days since Annalise was reported missing. Asking me questions about Tyler now wasn't going to change the outcome for her. They weren't looking for her. They were looking at him. Despite Daniel's good intentions, despite his warnings, if I didn't go out there, the police might think I had something to hide. I pulled on fresh clothes and padded barefoot down the stairs, the conversation muted behind the wood and plaster. I pushed open the screen door and shaded my eyes from the sun. "Daniel," I called. The unmarked car was parked halfway up the driveway. This cop wanted it to seem like he was just dropping by, just in the neighborhood, nothing serious. It was navy blue with tinted windows, and it needed to be washed. "Is everything okay?" I said. The man wasn't in uniform, and he was bigger than I'd thought, and younger, given his voice, about my age or younger, Annalise's age, which made him too young to be part of Corinne's investigation. The way he spoke made me think he wasn't from here, not this town anyway. An hour east was all it took to make a difference. The mountains and the single winding road kept this place separate, insular.
"Nicolette?"
He checked his notepad.
"Farrell?"
"Definitely not from here. Even if he was too young to know me personally, the names go with the houses. It wouldn't be a mystery. The Carter property backs to the Farrell property, and the McElrays own land on both sides, though neither was built on yet. The Lawsons made a bid for the house and land across the lane when Marty Piper, the last of the Pipers, passed after his third and final heart attack. But the house and the land were unoccupied, tangled in legalese and court paperwork. I was staring off through the woods in the direction of Marty's place when the cop said,
"Miss?"
"Yes," I said. Daniel rolled his neck and came to stand beside me on the porch.
"You're Nicolette Farrell?"
"I am."
"My name is Detective Charles. I was hoping to ask you a few questions about your relationship with Tyler Ellison."
He seemed to be waiting for something. Maybe for me to be the southern hostess like Laura, open the screen door and beckon him inside, offering him some tea. Outsiders only come in when the investigation shifts. Detective Charles, I was sure, was the new Hannah Pardoe. After he took a few hesitant strides toward the house, I walked down the porch steps, meeting him in the middle of the yard, my feet sinking into the ground, moist from last night's rain. "How's the motel?" I asked, just to check. "Or are they putting you up someplace nicer?" His mouth twisted.
"I'm sorry. Have we met?"
he asked. "You're not from here, are you?" I countered.
"No, ma'am,"
he said, flipping through his pad. He towered over me so I couldn't see the writing. He cleared his throat, pen poised over the paper.
"This will just take a moment. I'm following up on some questions here. Heard this might be a good place to start."
He didn't look up the entire time he spoke. Not until he said,
"Please describe your relationship with Tyler Ellison."
"This will be really fast, Detective. We have no relationship. Sorry you wasted your time coming out here." His eyes flicked up to mine, then back to his paper.
"How about in the past, then?"
"He was my high school boyfriend," I said. "I'm 28. He flipped pages back and forth, umming and uhing, before finding what he was looking for.
"You've been together since?"
he asked.
"It's my understanding that you've been seen with him since then."
I smiled up at him. "I live in Philadelphia, but when I used to come visit, sure."
"Not anymore?"
he asked. "I'm engaged," I said, and I saw his eyes drift to my bare finger. He flipped the pages again.
He's been seen around your house, more recently. Very recently."
I was getting irritated, and I didn't make any attempt to hide it. He's been helping... Daniel stepped forward, cut me off.
I asked him to. He runs a construction business. We're fixing up the house. Nick's only home for a little while. He's helping me as a favor.
Detective Charles faced my brother.
Your friends?
The briefest of pauses, but I felt it.
Yes,
Daniel said. Be smart. Give the most finite possible answer. Close the loop. Don't make unnecessary openings because they will seize them. They will fill them.
So, the thing is...
Detective Charles flipped pages and I caught a glimpse of a blank sheet. The jerk was playing me, playing us both. The pages were nothing, a few words scribbled in the margins. It was an act to pretend he didn't know who we were and all our history. In truth, he had it filed away in his head. He'd been studying us, and he was playing his angle. God, how long had he been here? I put a hand on Daniel's arm and applied the faintest pressure before Detective Charles looked back up.
The thing is, we can't find Annalise's cell, and it appears to be off. But we did get a look at her phone records, and the very last call she answered the night before she was reported missing was from Tyler Ellison, around 1 a.m.
It's my understanding that they were seeing each other, I said. He tapped his pen on the page.
No, see, that's the other thing. Tyler said they broke up. And when I looked into why that might be, because that's an awful big coincidence, break up with a girl and then she goes missing, talk around town is that it probably has something to do with you. And why do you think that might be?
I felt my jaw tighten, my hands tighten. Because, historically, that's what happened. And in this town, what happened in the past is all that will ever happen, Detective. If you were from here, you'd know that.
No need to get defensive, I'm just trying to understand.
Then ask Tyler.
I did,
he said.
Though he's a hard man to track down.
There was a time when all I had to do was conjure him to mind, just the wisp of a thought, and there he'd be in the flesh. As if I had summoned him. But now I had to agree. Tyler was starting to feel like a ghost. Like if I blinked for too long, he might slip away for good. Detective Charles tapped his pad.
He says he called Annalise at 1 a.m. and that, let me see, he decided to break it off because, quote, she wanted more than I was willing to give her. What do you suppose that means?
I'm assuming exactly what he said. He doesn't like to be tied down. He smiled, and it was unsettling. The shark ready to play his winning card.
That's quite the opposite of what I've been hearing. Looks like he's tied down really good here.
I shifted my weight from foot to foot. Look, up until last week, I hadn't talked to Tyler in over a year. I have no insight into the inner workings of their relationship. The detective caught the inflection in my voice. I was sure. And I fought to keep it steady as Daniel put a hand on my back. Calm down.
Miss Farrell, I'm not trying to get him into trouble or anything. I just want to get a feel for Annalise's state of mind that night.
Lie.
When were you and Tyler Ellison last... together?
He asked, keeping his eyes on his notepad. If you're asking what I think you're asking, that's kind of a personal question.
This is a missing persons investigation. Of course it's personal. Think of the girl, Miss Farrell.
Think of the girl. Last year, I said.
Not last week? Not when you returned home?
No, I said.
You return home, and Tyler allegedly breaks up with Annalise the same night, and then she's reported missing the following morning. You can see how this looks.
I could see what stories they had concocted, and the one they wanted me to feed back to them. But I'd been through this before. We all had. This kid, he didn't have a fucking clue. I understand that when the police have no leads, they become desperate, trying to find meaning where there's nothing, trying to connect unrelated dots into a picture they can understand, whether it's true or not. Daniel's phone rang, and he answered it right then without excusing himself.
Hello?
He said.
What?
He continued listening, and I kept my eyes on his face so I wouldn't have to look at Detective Charles, whose gaze I could feel burning a hole into the side of my skull.
"I'll be right there,"
he said, then to the detective.
"Our dad isn't well. We have to go. Good luck with the case."
He turned to face me.
"They need us to come in. Right now."
"Oh, God," I said, running into the house, locking the doors, grabbing my shoes and purse. Daniel already had the car running by the time I was outside, on the phone with the insurance company he was working with as a field adjuster, explaining that he couldn't make it to the site. Daniel assessed damages for a living, worked out of his home, going wherever one of several companies sent him in the region. Everything was a checklist. There was a formula to disaster, misfortune, and tragedy. Everything had a value and a cost. I suppose he got accustomed to digging through facts, assigning blame, detecting fraud, or he found out he was good at it. After he'd lived through Corinne's case, maybe it was a comfort to him, finding the logic in the chaos, finding the truth.
"No,"
he said.
"I won't make it out today at all. I'll double up tomorrow. Yeah, call it a sick day."
He was calling Laura as we drove down the road. The detective was sitting in his car, making notes to himself, pretending not to watch us as we drove away. Dad was in restraints, flat on his back, eyes fixed on the ceiling. The room was full of people, all of whom worked there in one capacity or another. When Daniel and I barged in, the doctor made a show of placing his fingers on the inside of Dad's wrist, which was limp and restrained by a thick ivory strap. "What the hell are you doing to him?" I asked, pushing past the doctor and working on a restraint that had been buckled around Dad's other wrist.
"Ms. Farrell?"
There was a hand on my shoulder, but the voice sounded farther away.
"Ms. Farrell?"
A woman's voice, more forceful now, and then the hand moved to my wrist, restraining my own movement.
"It's for his safety. And ours."
I looked at the hand on my wrist, the long fingers and cracked knuckles, leading to the knobby wrist and the slender arm. Daniel. It was then that I got a good look at everyone in the room. A nurse looked shaken, half her hair pulled free from a bun. There were two men in the room who didn't appear to be doctors or nurses and were watching Dad carefully. And the woman who'd spoken my name, dressed in business attire and standing near the doorway.
"He's sedated now," the woman said, "but we don't know what shape he'll be in when he wakes up."
The air was stale and cold and seemed so impersonal. No sense of home. Medicine, cleansers, bleach. It couldn't be good for his memory. He needed to smell the wood floors and the forest behind our house. He needed the exhaust from his crappy car and the grease from Kelly's pub. Well, when he wakes up to find himself physically restrained, I can tell you right now it won't be good, I said. She pressed her lips together and stuck out her hand in my direction, not giving me any choice but to take it.
"I'm Karen Adelson, the director here. I don't think I've had the pleasure of meeting you yet, Miss Farrell. Come, please, to my office. Both of you."
She didn't let go of my hand, instead taking hold of my elbow with her other hand.
"He'll be fine. Someone will stay with him."
Her hand on my elbow moved to my lower back, and she led me out of the room, Daniel at my side. Karen Adelson was dressed smart, like how I modeled myself in Philadelphia. Pencil skirt, black trendy flats, blouse cut to look both professional and feminine. She dropped her hand as we walked in a straight line against the right side of the hall, making room for wheelchairs and service carts. Smiling tightly, she checked over her shoulder to make sure we were following. Her blouse was sheer with a camisole underneath, and it was so at odds with her makeup-free face and hair pulled into a severe bun that I couldn't get a grasp on her. We followed her into an outer office with potted plants on either side of bay windows, and a desk with a secretary who smiled absently in our direction.
"Hold my calls," Karen said as she strode past into her office.
Three cushioned chairs and a couch on one side, her desk on the other. She gestured toward the couch. Daniel sank into the cushions, but I remained standing. Everett would never sit there. "You'll lose the upper hand, Nicolette," I could imagine him whispering into my ear. Everett was like that, always teaching me how to handle myself in situations, as if he could mold me into his equal. I imagined his father doing the same for him, teaching him that line to walk, and a miniature Everett nodding, learning, copying, becoming. Karen sat on the chair across from the couch, and I stood beside the couch, close to Daniel.
"I'm concerned," she said. "Your father had an episode this morning." "What does that even mean?"
Daniel said.
"An episode."
"He became extremely agitated." "It's because there's nothing here to help him remember," I said. "I'd be agitated if I woke up in a place I didn't know."
"That may be true, Miss Farrell. I don't deny his right to those feelings, but his outburst went beyond disorientation. I'm afraid I'd have to call it paranoia, and it makes me question whether this is the right facility for him. Perhaps he would be better suited to a place that can care for those specific needs."
"Paranoia?"
Daniel asked.
"Yes. He was yelling that someone was after his daughter, and he refused to remain here. He was unmanageable. He became violent, insisting that he had to get out, get to you, help you."
She stared at me, and I looked away, imagining him yelling for his daughter, for me. My spine tingled, paranoia or not.
"It took two men to restrain him so a doctor could sedate him, but all he kept saying was, 'My daughter's not safe.'"
I felt Daniel staring at my face. The chill moved up my spine, hollowing out the room and my stomach and my lungs.
"If this was an event in the past, I could understand," she continued. "That would be more in line with what we know of his condition. Was it? Were you once in danger, Miss Farrell?"
I shook my head. "I don't know what's happening to him." His words echoing over and over as if I'd heard them myself.
"Well, as I said, the paranoid delusions make me question if he's in the right facility," she said, driving home the point of our meeting.
"It's my fault,"
Daniel said.
"Excuse me?"
Karen said. We were both staring at him. His cheeks were burning as if he'd been working in the sun too long.
"Our neighbor went missing. Annalise Carter. Maybe you've seen it on the news." I told him. I realize in hindsight that was a mistake. It just slipped out. She disappeared in the woods behind our house where my sister is staying. I wanted him to hear it from me and not the news. I shouldn't have told him. I'm sorry. It's not paranoia, though. It's confusion. It's a mistake.
Karen tilted her head to the side, assessing my brother's words. She finally nodded.
"That's understandable. Upsetting, to say the least. We will need to continue to monitor him, however. If this becomes a pattern..."
"I'm sorry," he said. "I'll talk to him."
"Let me," I said. "I'm the one he was talking about." I was glad that I was standing, glad for the confidence in my posture. Karen stood.
"I think that's a good idea."
"Without the restraints," I said. Daniel went to the cafeteria to order three lunches to bring back to Dad's room. I was sitting cross-legged on the chair in the corner, drinking a soda from the vending machine when Dad finally woke. There was an orderly in the room near the door, per Karen's request.
"Hi, Dad," I said tentatively.
He rubbed absently at his wrists, and I could see the red chafing mark against his wrist bone. I leaned over his bed so he'd see me before he saw the room he didn't own and the man he didn't know.
"You're okay," I said.
"I'm okay." He pushed himself up and winced.
"Nick?"
he said, his eyes focusing, narrowing, roaming. "You're at Grand Pines, and you're fine, and I'm here, and I'm fine." He reached his hand, placed it on the side of my face.
"Nick, thank God. Nick, it's not safe for you."
"Shh, Dad," I said, looking at the man beside the door. "I'm fine." Daniel walked in with our lunches at that moment, three stacked styrofoam boxes, and Daniel's here, see? We're fine. Dad sat up like a child in bed after a nightmare, both relieved and terrified. He looked at Daniel, at me, at the man beside the door.
You'll take care of her?
He said to Daniel. Daniel opened the boxes, looked inside each, and passed them out.
Yes, Dad,
he said, and I felt a lump rise in my throat.